My grandfather, my mother's father, had a wealthy buddy who lost all his money in the war. So he became a Buddhist monk, and he lived on that island in Hong Kong when it was just a sleepy village with a monastery at the top of the hill, before they built that giant Buddha statue and made it into a tourist attraction. So when I was a kid, my family, along with uncles and aunts and cousins, we would regularly go on a ferry and go visit that old man for a weekend. And we would hike from his house up to the hill to the monastery to eat monk food. Now, quite often on the climb to the monastery, one of the grown-ups would take pity on me with my four-year-old little legs trying to keep up with them on the climb. And so they would pick me up and put me on their shoulders to carry me up the rest of the way. So to this day, my uncle tells a story of how once when I was on his shoulders, and as he huffed and puffed doing the heavy lifting for both of us, I on his shoulder would get cheeky and start talking like a little princeling, loudly declaring from on his shoulders, "What a lovely view from up here," just to rub it in a bit. Now, I don't remember that, actually. And I, like most kids, just sort of take nature for granted. But I do remember the first time I felt really awed by God's creation. I was probably 10 or so when my scout leaders took us to that island for our first camping trip. And on that night, away from the lights of the city, we lied on this grassy knoll and watched a meteor shower. And I was blown away. There we were staring into the vastness of space and stars as far as the eyes could see. But yet, you know, that feeling of the smallness of me, of being something part of, or being part of something huge and magical and sacred. And stars do that to me every time. This is what David reminds me of. In the first part of Psalm 19, when he says, "The heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands." That creation carries the wordless signature of the Creator who gave us life and continues to give us life. That creation is not just something pretty for show, but it is an entire ecosystem with everything we need for our flourishing life. The world started as paradise, Genesis says. So I was telling someone about what stars do to me, and he said, "For me, it's mountains." Maybe you have something like that. Some sort of brush with nature that stirs your soul and makes you wonder how it all came to be, how you came to be, and who put you here and why. Now, after talking about the way nature points us to a creator, David now shifts his attention to talking about the law, which may be a bit of a leap for us, but let's go with it. Now, by law, David is talking about what we call the Ten Commandments. "The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul," he says. This needs a bit of unpacking for us, because I doubt any of us in this room would say we love the law the way we love cake. Now, we don't love the law because we think laws are restrictive. So we want to go faster on the freeway, but there's a sign that tells us not to, or we might get into trouble. But that's not how the ancient Jewish people thought of the laws. For one thing, what our English Bibles call commandments come from a word in Hebrew that simply means words, like instructions. These were the instructions that Moses taught the Jewish people off stone tablets, and they became what they called the law. Before this, they had been slaves in Egypt just days earlier. Before Moses went head to head with the Pharaoh and rescued them, and the whole thing of being a slave is that you never have to do your own thinking. Somebody with a whip did your thinking for you. So the slaves need some sort of guidance on how to live out their newfound freedom as a free people, with each other and with God, their benefactor, who took notice of them when they were nobodies at the bottom of an Egyptian food chain and went of his way to mount a rescue So these 10 words were God's instruction to them about getting along. They were part of a manual for healthy relationships, how to treat God and each other with respect so they can flourish and thrive together. These instructions were God's gift to them, and that's why they loved the law. If you've bought anything from IKEA, you know, as you stare at the 100 pieces of wood and nuts and bolts all spread out on your floor, you know you need that little booklet to make all of that into a bookcase. Now, you're not thinking, oh no, I better read that carefully and do what it says, or else the IKEA police is going to come and put me into IKEA prison. That booklet is there to help you get the bookcase you want. And that's how the Jewish people think about God's life instructions. David says they're trustworthy and wise. They create order out of chaos, light our way out of when we cannot see, and fill our hearts with joy. Before I went to Paris, I went to that dollar store near my house where you buy things for a buck. And I bought a little compass the size of a nickel with a ring that I can attach onto my knapsack. I don't know how many times, as I stood disoriented and lost on a Paris street corner, that little compass pointed me to the right direction to face to read my map so I can get on my way on the right path. So the same God who made a beautiful habitat for humans has also given humans a compass to the good life. And that's why David says God's instructions are precious like gold and sweet like honey, all gifts from God so we can flourish and thrive. So far, so good, right? Well, in verse 12, David ends up in this unexpectedly dark place. Forgive me, help me with my hidden faults, David says. That somehow his meditation on the beauty and largeness of creation and the orderliness of God's instructions, David finds himself looking inward. And he finds himself thinking about things he's not proud of, which he keeps hidden from the world. How many people on the planet knows the worst thing to know about you? And are you and them all okay with that? David feels inspired to be a better person, to live a better life, but he doesn't know how to get there. And he asks, who will help me with the ugly in me? Brené Brown calls this a moment of spiritual awakening. When we see things the way they really are and things in us that don't work, behind our protective armor and disguises. One pastor says, we're like the Titanic, you know, the sinking ship, if you've seen the movie. There's the upper deck with all the wealth and glamour of a luxury cruise ship, people all dressed to the nines. And then there are the lower decks, where the real people in rags, huddled in crowded quarters. And he writes, actually, it is those very lower decks where our spiritual lives take true shape and texture. But notoriously, we won't take time to go deep down within because we often have been discipled to superficiality. This superficiality works against us as we try to navigate some of the most complex issues of our world, whether related to our emotional health or the complexity of race, sexuality, and justice. In the Psalms, David started on the upper deck. Then he found God gently leading him below decks to face his hidden faults, to see the baggage there that keeps him from having the life he dreams of, from having the safe and secure relationships he needs. And he admits he can't do it. He needs help. Because to make a change, as I was told in MBA class, you have to first take an honest survey of where you are, to see where your starting point is, before you can plot a course to get to where you want to go. In the 60s, somebody did a mouse experiment. They built mouse paradise, a temperature-controlled, habitat with all the food the mice can eat. There were no predators, no disease, no competition, no threats, and they started with 8 mice. The habitat had room for 3,000. And sure enough, at the beginning, every 2 months, the population doubled. But to their surprise, when they got just over 500 mice, just about 20% full, the mouse civilization started to collapse. It started in one corner of the habitat. The dominant males retreated to themselves. They just sat licking themselves and lost all interest in life and mating. Meanwhile, some of the females started attacking each other, even their own children. It was supposed to be mouse paradise, except the mouse became antisocial, selfish, and violent. So the problem in mouse paradise turned out to be the mice themselves. Just like the problem in the world turns out to be us. There's something wrong inside the operating system of the mice that ruined mouse paradise, and that same bug is in us. That bug is why civilization seems to be collapsing around us, despite all of our tech and knowledge. Humans are the number one cause of the worst loss of lives disasters, this website says. The historian Thomas Cahill says the history is written in blood. And here we are doing some soul searching about our inhumane past here on Truth and Reconciliation Sunday. Recently, 1 out of 5 people say they're unhappy. Recently, 1 out of 5 people say they were happy. Only 1 in 5. The UN has been meeting in New York this last week for the annual summit, and the mood, the newspaper says, has been grim. One of the ambassadors says, "We have never seen this many ongoing conflicts around the world before. With 100 million people driven from their homes and record high casualty of civilians." He says the world is becoming less stable, less peaceful, with erosion of respect for the rules and sliding into a state of disorder. Apparently, in a very lopsided basketball game, when it becomes hopeless for the losing team to turn the game around, that time they have to play out the clock, the kids call that garbage time. Recently, on social media, Chinese young people have been calling their lives garbage time. Because this year, of the 12 million college graduates in China, only over one in five have not been able to find jobs. That's something like 21% unemployment for the 16 to 24 year olds. And their future is bleak with AI and robots on the horizon. Meanwhile, scammers are targeting them for money lending schemes. And in a recent documentary, some of them say they advise young people to not go to college, not get married, and not have kids, because that is the only way to survive. But surviving is not thriving. It's not flourishing. Meanwhile, our culture on this side of the world is obsessed with the superficial upper deck stuff. Brené Brown asks, have we turned into a culture of self-absorbed, grandiose people who are only interested in power, success, beauty, and being special? And so entitled that we actually believe we're superior, even when we're not making any contribution or achieving anything of value. Is it true that we lack the necessary empathy to be compassionate, connected people? Another writer calls this doom, the feeling of dread and hopelessness of the moment with the world in garbage time. So 3,000 years ago, David awakens to some sense of internal doom. Now, Paul actually describes a similar awakening in Romans. In Romans 1, he starts talking about God's imprint in creation, just like David. In Romans 2, he talks about the law, just like David. But as wise as the law is, it has no power to make us good. Any more than that sign on the freeway can make us drive at the right speed. And in Romans 3, just like David, Paul gets into the hidden faults in the human software. Paul says all creatures have been corrupted by the sin bug, and we're helpless to live as the masterpieces that God made us to be. And then in Romans 7, Paul, the spiritual giant, admits he himself struggles in the same way we do. He says, I do not understand what I do, for what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. What the Bible calls sin is a way bigger problem than just you or me doing a bad thing. There's some sort of malfunction in the human software that makes us destructive as a species. We can't do the right thing for ourselves or the world even when we know what the right thing is and even when we know what is needed. Now, when you have a bug in your soup, you don't spoon around it. You have to throw the whole thing out, right? The creation story in Genesis records the moment when we first discovered the bug in the software. When Adam and Eve decided to use their God-given freedom to eliminate God from their life. So we're building bookcases without the instructions, and we're trying to find a way in pairs without that little compass to tell us which way to hold the map. And just like when our computers get infected with a virus, we need to wipe the drive clean and do a clean install of the operating system. But some of us might need to call on an IT guy for help, because we're not really wanting to throw the computer away, just like God refuses to throw creation away. What Paul knew that David didn't was that our prayer for help from doom has been answered. It's why Jesus came and why Easter has good news for us. God gives us the help we need so we can be set free from the tyranny of the hidden faults. My friend posted this on his Facebook wall. The difference between Jesus and religion shames people for having dirty feet. Jesus kneels down to wash dirty feet. The first Easter is about Jesus coming to do something to fix creation, to get rid of the bug in the soup without throwing out the soup. Jesus did a reboot of the human software when he died on Friday. The bug in the software died with him. And then when God raised him from the dead, this was the clean install we needed to start over without the virus. The new life is what the Bible calls resurrection, and resurrection changes everything for those of us who want it, one soul at a time. David Nahiri, the writer, wrote this about his Iranian mother's dangerous decision to become a Christian. She fixed her eyes on something beyond the river of blood to a beautiful place on the other side. What you believe about the future will change how you live in the present. Resurrection is hope in the face of doom. And it's not what we humans can engineer on our own. God's promise is that death is not the end, and what we destroy, he will remake one day. I don't know about you, I have never found it easy to ask for help. So I admire people who can take care of business all on their own. Like this doctor from New York who answered an ad to go work at the science station in Antarctica to be the only doctor looking after 47 people who were there at the time to replace the roof. And then one day, she found a lump in her breast. This was the time of the year when the base is frozen in and nothing can get in or out. So she decided to do her own biopsy on the lump. How many of us can pull that off? But even she needed help. There was a specialist that she contacted by email who helped her with diagnosis and treatment. One of the welders practiced poking a needle into an apple before poking it into her to get a tissue sample. And one of the computer tech had to figure out how to send pictures of the slides by satellite to that specialist. She needed help, and she had no choice but to ask for it. Jesus gives us the help we need so we can live the life we imagine to be possible. Jesus did all the heavy lifting, and we just have to say yes to get in on the reboot by climbing on his shoulders the way my uncle carried me up the hill. When I was baptized at 16 at a Baptist church on Granville and 49th, when I went into the water, I rode on Jesus' shoulders and died with him. And then when I came out of the water, I rode on Jesus' shoulders and was raised back to life and began my new life in resurrection. Jesus has done all the heavy lifting. I just have to get on him for the ride. Russell Brand, the British comedian and actor, has lived a pretty wild life by his own admissions. Over the past few years, he has been carrying on a very public spiritual search in the podcast, his spiritual awakening, where he says, for me, without some sense of a deeper truth, for me, there's only hedonism, only indulgence. Well, recently, he became a follower of Jesus, and he was baptized in the River Thames in London. And in his baptism, he says, the truth is this. As a person that has in the past taken many, many substances and always been disappointed with an inability to deliver the kind of tranquility and peace and even transcendence I have always felt I've been looking for, something occurred in the process of baptism that was incredible, overwhelming, because I was obviously underwater. So I felt change, transitioned. I'm so grateful to be surrendered in Christ. But that's just the beginning for him, like every Christian. He, like all of us, have a lot of hidden faults to work through, but we do it a bit at a time with God's help. One of Billy Graham's grandson, who's a pastor, and also has been working through a lot of brokenness publicly, he said this about Christians talking about becoming like Jesus. He says, for him at this moment, he confesses, his life doesn't look like Jesus. He looks like someone who needs Jesus. The first step to a new life is to be open to our moment of spiritual awakening, to come clean about our mess and admit we need God's help because we can't do it on our own. And the good news is that Jesus has already done what we need. So we keep saying yes to God and trust the process when the going gets tough, when God leads us into a moment of awakening, we follow him to the lower decks below the superficial to see what is the next thing he wants to help us to get free from. And we keep saying yes as God's spirit continues to reconstruct our authentic selves, the person God designed when he thought us up, so we can live the life we always dreamed of. Take a moment, begin a conversation with God, and then there's a prayer. A blessing for when you don't feel fulfilled anymore. God, I will wake up today and move numbly into each hour. I will fill my lungs with the air of an undone, unfinished, never-before-seen day, entirely certain of how I will feel when it ends. Tired, bored, unchanged. God, even my best efforts, my sacrificial love, my diligent work don't stir up anything, like the rush of accomplishment. Whatever felt like meaning isn't meaningful anymore, at least not today. One minute I want to change everything, and the next I want to crawl back into bed. But if I'm honest, how much of my actual day-to-day life could I change, even if I wanted to? Lord, this is the simplest prayer. Make it matter again. Color my grayscale vision with every shade of meaning. Blues and purples and lilacs for purpose. Reds and pinks for every kind of love. Yellows for insights and ideas that sparkle. And if one's cherished dreams need to fade, let them fade. Let me not imagine that each one of my plans must glue my future together. Surprise me. But let me come alive to the wonder of this day. Amen.